Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad. I had a wonderful discussion about innovation with Louise Musel. She's an author of numerous articles for technical magazines and lecture on the topics of innovation, open innovation, and business trends in research and development. We met at the Product Innovation Management Conference, where she presented on the topic of working with small companies to expand your open innovation capabilities. She also has written about this in the book, Open Innovation, New Product Development Essentials from PDMA. Let's get to the interview. You are currently the Vice President of Strategy and Business Development for a company called PCD Works down near Tyler, Texas. And my understanding is that's a company specializing in new product development and design, kind of with a science and engineering focus. What is your role involved there in business development and strategy?
It's a big title in a little company. So I do a bit of everything. You know, a lot of times what my role is to seek out, you know, new clients, but we're very much a relationship-based company. So it's a lot of our old, our continued relationship with clients, keeping up with them, but also seeking out new opportunities. You know, as a small company, we have the ability to be flexible in, you know, how we conduct our business, you know, seeking out new partnerships, seeking out new opportunities. So I do a bit of that. We've spun off two companies so far, which is Active Water Solutions, which was a partnership between PCD Works and Sam Houston State University. We took that was their first foray into commercializing research, which was...
Let's break that spinoff down just a little bit. So,
okay.
So your company is an innovation company. So who was the client that came to you in this case with a problem that needed some help?
So it was Sam Houston State University.
And what problem were they bringing to you to investigate?
Well, it wasn't even us investigating. So they had taken research. So what the product was is they had a consortium of microbes that could break down wastewater and create nearly potable water.
Ah. Okay.
You're right. So biologically, biological, yes, remediation of human waste. And so, you know, a lot of universities are getting into the commercialization side of research. And so they had some prototypes out there, and two of the lead researchers had seen Mike, my boss, speak at a lecture for the military, it was sort of before I got in here. But they'd seen him speak. They said, I want to work with this company. They have exactly what we need. So they had done the research aspect of it. So what they needed was a way to commercialize it. So the goal was to create for the Department of Defense in a portable, autonomous, fixed film bioreactor. And so that is what we did. So completely autonomous, you know, you can send it out into the field, it can clean wastewater, you can monitor it remotely, whenever it goes down, you can, you know, fix the glitches there, or it can send notes, hey, this needs to be done, to whoever the field specialist is. So that was what that product had to do. So we took the sort of the mechanism for it and created and developed that. So all the software, all the autonomy, all the control system. We designed the actual container that it was in. They're in 40-foot ISO containers, so you can deploy them easily. They're scalable, all that good stuff. In fact, it won the 2010 Wall Street Journal Technology Innovation Award, the environmental category.
Great recognition from Wall Street.
It was great recognition. In fact, little side note, we went to the awards ceremony in Palo Alto, and I think it was Venture Tech that put it on. Venture Tech Beat, one of the publications. And so they had a ton of, you know, software companies over there, and, you know, everyone there, gotta love Silicon Valley, but very enamored with software, not really interested in the really sexy topic of wastewater treatment. So educational location means everything, which
right.
You win an award. So, but it was an experience.
Oh, I bet. You know, being in the crowd of software folks, and you're there with biological approach to eating waste.
Yeah, it's not really the sexiest topic you can talk about.
Pretty darn important, though.
Man, I tell you what, I mean, if there is something that needs help, it is our wastewater. I have more information and knowledge on, you know, wastewater and challenges that we're about to face in the next 10 years than I probably
personally expected. Some of the charities that really enjoy being a part of, one is Compassion International, their Water of Life program, right? Because they're providing a very simple technology with the partner they worked with, which was in the Department of Defense space originally. Mm-hmm. Now it's commercially available. So Sawyer, and they make this simple water filter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And right next to that, though, when you look at the third world problems we're having, it's the clean water and it's what you do with the waste, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm curious. So you guys, it sound like you were all involved in taking the research concept and commercializing it, putting everything Correct. Around it to turn this into a product that could be fielded to people. Mm-hmm. And the customer right now, that you said, was Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. Is that being taken any further by anyone to other markets, other customers?
You know, I don't know, because the company was acquired almost immediately.
That was the spinoff you talked about.
Yeah, so, I mean, literally, we shipped it out to Afghanistan, and then the company was acquired by a private oil company, actually. A little different direction, mm-hmm. But still very necessary, you know, water. You need tons of water in oil production, fracking, all that stuff. So the goal for them was to, you know, remediate some of the frack fluid coming out. Now, I don't really know what's going on with it, because we're out of it. We've been out of it for almost 3 years now.
Yeah, so. But what a fascinating project. You know,
Oh, man. You learn a lot by doing that stuff.
Yeah. And clean water is one of the, you know, our next crisis probably.
We're already there, buddy. We're already there. Promise you. We just don't hear enough about it because it's still cheap. As soon as it gets expensive, we'll pay more attention to it.
So really, we might get back to that really interesting example of commercializing a concept that came out of research, in this case, university research. I'm curious about your journeys. Mm-hmm. A lot of people that I have the pleasure of working with are moving into some kind of product development role, innovation role, you know, or growing their career, right? And it seems like we tend to have a wide variety of experiences, you know, the people that are doing those things. How did you end up in this space? Any key experiences from your life stand out that kind of paved the way for you to end up here? That maybe you didn't realize at the time, but you now look back and go, oh, you know, that actually kind of worked out.
I'd like to say yes, but the truth is we are a family-owned business. My father is the visionary, the brains behind, you know, what we do here and how it functions. And just a quick side note, I mean, I don't know, the audience probably doesn't know this about PCB Works, but we're actually on an innovation campus. So we're on 80 acres out in the middle of nowhere, East Texas. And the thought process behind this is that, you know, distraction-free innovation is really how you have to focus on innovation. You can't, you know, in large corporations, we have these, you know, we have meetings and, you know, we're constantly being bombarded from all these different directions to produce and to move forward, and, you know, meetings, you know, actually don't have time to actually sit down and do some of the work of the innovation side and really focus on what those challenges are. So much so to the point where some of our clients come up here when they think that they have one problem, but it's actually, they're misattributing it to a larger issue at hand. And so by being out in the country and being not having access to the norms of daily life, it's a much more thorough and effective process. But it's also the people. It's, you know, we have a prototype shop, we have 7 labs, we have, you know, a staff of 18 that's, you know, multidisciplinary, electrical, mechanical, physicist, biologists. So having all those different disciplines coming together regularly, it really lends itself to a lot of knowledge creation. So getting back to the question, though, that's just sort of a brief background about, you know, the vision and how we got here is that my father, actually, who is the co-founder and sort of the visionary behind the facility and the campus, he is a cognitive psychologist by training. He's also an architect.
Interesting combination.
Correct. He is also an industrial designer. He taught industrial design for quite a few years. And then really what he should have been doing all that time is physics. He is a true creative type. He's a true what I call his curiosity quotient is greater than the average person's. His want and need for knowledge and understanding.
Right.
So that being instilled, you know, in my childhood was always, you know, I said, you know, oh, here's a camera. I want to get into photography. How does it work? Well, that lends itself to a two-hour lecture on SLR and where lenses are made. So, you know, just by having a parent who sort of lends themselves to maybe too much information sometimes, but it leads to all these other conversations. So that was a good basis for the watch.
So you grew up in this influence of looking at things kind of in a different light about how what work, you know, how it came about, what problems they were solving.
Absolutely.
It sounds like there was a lot of creative energy probably in your household.
No, and my mother is also an architect as well. So, you know, and our freedom to go out and try. We have four brothers. There's five children total. I think that lends itself to just having to go out and figure things out on your own. I think that's a benefit.
Yep.
It's not just one thing, but it's all of these things. But, you know, I sort of came to PCD Works by default, not because my parents own it, but because they wanted my husband. he's a real ninja project manager.
You were in the biological family. You managed to marry into the family that brought you
right.
to the
company. Pretty much.
Yeah.
But when they launched Active Water Solutions in 2009, they recruited him to come down and say, you know, hey, we need help with this. This is a one-year project that we have to do all of these things. We need you to come down here and manage this project and really help us move it forward. He's an amazing individual. And so they said, well, why don't you come down? I was teaching at Montana State at the time. Of course, I'm going to come down too with our children. But they said, well, we'll hire you. You can be our marketing coordinator, you know, you know, that's just sort of coordinating all the activities and whatever. Well, it turns out I'm really good at talking to people, and I'm a quick learner, and I'm a quick study, and I'm curious, and...
being curious makes a big difference, right?
Huge.
We're in this innovation space. Like you said something earlier I want to pick up on too is, you know, people come to your innovation campus and it has a name, a nickname, right? What is it, Think Tank on the Hill? Envious, because I looked up the pictures of it. And went, oh, man, I'd love to just come and sit in on some of the discussions you guys have. That, you know, people come with one problem that actually is probably a different problem, right? And having the opportunity to get out of their own element and some outside influences. I think people who are naturally curious, we tend to think about problems and solutions in different ways. You know?
Oh, yeah.
And how we frame the problem makes all the difference in what paths we go down.
Yeah, and your willingness to look beyond what you know and to sort of put your assumptions aside. I mean, that's really... You know, just because you don't know or you think it works this way, it doesn't always mean that that's the accurate, and that's really how it works. So,
In doing a little research to talk with you, a friend, it turns out to be a mutual friend of ours, but a friend described your father as a polymath, which I had to look up because this is probably a word I should know. But and you already described him well as a polymath, but a polymath is that Renaissance man who has expertise in lots of different disciplines, you know, knowledge that spans lots of different subjects.
Right.
And so it sounds like, you know, you had some young influences here along the way to kind of prepare you for a path of, you know, something to do with innovation in some sense.
Yes.
But then, you know, I know you got really involved in the arts, theater.
Yes.
And tell me how you think that might have played in.
I think, you know, naturally, I'm a very visual person, having architects as parents, having grown up in art museums, you know, that was very much an important part of our youth. You know, we did tons of, you know, just hands-on projects. Photography was a huge, impactful thing in my youth from the time I was, like, 8 to all the way through high school. I was a very active photographer. I decided not to pursue it because I don't want to say it was too easy or too, because it's not easy, but it was sort of like I'd done it for so long I wanted to, you know, get into something else, but it was always the visual understanding of things and how to tell a story. I'm not a great storyteller by any stretch. We all know those great storytellers. We can, you know, it's like, oh man, they just have this ability. I have to really work on my storytelling. I'm very much a stream of consciousness, need to get all that information out to the audience. So, but that being said, I think what makes a great storyteller is not having the story known and decided from the get-go, but being able to filter out the unnecessaries and to keep it simple and to where, you know, the narrative can take place. And so looking back at that, what I do now a lot of times is listening and trying to distill out what the narrative of what the client needs, what the client wants. As an actress, I did a lot of acting when I was younger and in college. You become an observer of humans. And, you know, when you're doing voice of the customer stuff, this is a really important thing to be able to look at and understand and sort of recognize where the shifts are coming on, where the, you know, the subtleties within that, the communication and the conversation, it's really helpful. So even though, you know, everyone, I got a film production degree, a media and theater arts degree, I find that there's a lot of parallels to what I do now, which is how do we get from point A to point B, right? Mm-hmm. How do you start a movie? How do you get the right team together? How do you work cohesively together? How do you communicate? Oh my God. That's like my big, we must communicate more right. with everyone in the world, you know? And really, to me, definitions and terminology are key. When in any group, some people get frustrated with me, like my husband, I would say, because I ask him the same question maybe multiple times, but it's not because I'm questioning his ability. I just want to make sure I'm understanding. And so.
Yeah. And that's the way that you work. That's how you help yourself understand something, right?
And make sure that things are on track, right?
And I think that's an important part of the innovation process, right? Because, you know, a lot of things we could pull out there that you just said, the storytelling and filtering out what is not important, right? And focusing on what is important. And innovation part, as innovators, when we're trying to understand the voice of the customer, whatever form that takes, you know, ethnographic research, we're doing our user observations, or we're doing interviews, things that get said or even things that get observed and we try to communicate that to other people on the team, there's a stretch there, you know, we're using different words and people interpret things differently, and if they weren't part of the original experience, it's hard to share that information. And
absolutely.
And I like that technique, that, you know, of asking the same or similar question to try to just probe more about what they're really saying. There's a real good chance anytime we're talking about something that might become a requirement for a product, you know, if there's two people involved, there's probably at least two different perspectives on what that requirement is. Right?
Absolutely. And what does that mean to you? I mean, that's what I ask my engineers all the time. So what does that mean? What does that mean to you? Is that an issue, or is that a good thing, or, you know, what does that mean? You know, because a lot of times they look at it from such a different perspective than the end user or the, you know, or the project manager, or, you know, and so those technical things, it's really important to sort of get it distilled down to, okay, good, bad, you know, go, no go, new path, what, you know, what is it at its very core? You know, and sometimes I feel like, you know, these are stupid questions. Well, I wouldn't say now I think, but it's really, you know, now that I'm bringing them on my journey with me as to how and when I'm talking to the client, they start to say, okay, so now they're starting to break it down a little more so that all can be part of that conversation.
Yeah, I think we need a reframe because I do the same thing, right? I'm sure we all do. Say, well, gosh, if I ask this really simple question, it's going to sound stupid. But we need to reframe that as, you know, these aren't stupid questions. These are simple questions, but they're simple questions that expose information that everyone needs to know, right? And
absolutely.
You know, like the 5-why technique that a lot of people have used before, just simply asking why over and over to try to dive deep to understand the real root issue or real root problem is super effective. And why is a pretty simple question.
So, absolutely.
You know, we got to get away from thinking we're asking stupid questions, but we're just trying to learn what's going on.
So. Yeah, and sometimes it requires you to say, I'm just trying to understand, because people get frustrated. They're like, why are you asking me this over and over again? It's like, it's not that you're giving me the wrong answer. It's just, you know, it's just not, I'm not getting it yet. So help me by, by sorting through it, yeah. You know.
Well, and even if you're playing that role of Columbo, you know, the detective that asked the very simple, probing, penetrating questions, mm-hmm. And everyone thought he was a bubbling idiot until he came up with, you know, the whodunit conclusion. Mm-hmm. That's how we uncover things, and we get people to think about things more deeply. That's what we need.
Absolutely.
Very cool. You have this methodology called immersive ideation. Right, mm-hmm. that you guys do there. Can you give me an example, maybe with a real customer, of kind of what that methodology looks like? You know, how do you guys figure out how to commercialize a product, like in the water example?
Typically, when people are coming to us, they've got a real need. Okay, they have to get something out within the next 3 to 5 years, 1 to 2 years, whatever it is, whatever the time frame, and they are struggling with some sort of technology issue, or sometimes it's bandwidth, but it's usually technology. It's a little deeper, it's a little more challenging. Mm-hmm. And so they come with, you know, a problem statement. They don't just come up, though, because we do a lot of research on the front end, right, to try and understand, you know, what's going on in other industries and parallel industries, what technology is doing, what the trends are. So we do a ton of work on the front end.
And on the front end, is that even before the customer gets to your location, the think tank?
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. It's probably a good month of collecting information, data, what they've done historically, what they're doing in their other divisions. You'd be amazed at how many companies don't really know what's going on in their other divisions that they could actually utilize. You know, everybody, there's a lot of companies that still have silos.
Yep.
In their technology development, and they're actually working maybe on some similar things, maybe not. But, you know, we do patent research, we do white paper research, we ask experts, we'll go and, you know, so it's a lot of
secondary research to kind of get your hands just around the space and the problem and what the factors are involved.
Absolutely. And so our clients will come up to us and or come to our our facility here in East Texas, and our it's typically 3 to 5 days, and we basically deep dive into it. And we always ask that there's at least one marketing person and one engineer there. And our groups have been from anywhere between, you know, two people, it's usually not two people, it's usually three at the minimum, but we've had a couple that have just had two for sort of smaller projects, anywhere from two to no more than 10. Mm-hmm. And 10 on their end is very large, which usually doesn't happen, but you really don't want any more than 12 because we have to bring our engineers in too, and our whoever's involved in this, in the immersion process.
So keep the group small, so you can keep communication moving.
Yeah, I mean, it's challenging to, especially when you're going through these activities and these, you know, the ideation process, to have too many people involved. It's just you tend to break up beyond that the group, right? Then you get into these smaller groups within the group, which is not very effective. So we try to keep no more than 12 total. So depending on what size from our end we need, 12 is about the max that we want. So they come up in 3 to 5 days, and we basically we dissect the problem and the challenges for them. They bring us up to speed from their perspective. We bring in the research that we've done. We'll bring in external experts that we choose that we think might be a good fit. For that project, we have a pretty wide network of experts that we like to utilize, that we have relationships with already. Very wonderful people, very smart, creative thinkers. You don't want to just bring in an expert. You have to bring in someone who understands sort of the process.
That understands the creative process, yeah.
The creative process, and that has that curiosity quotient that, you know, we talk about, you know, mm-hmm. always looking beyond what the norm is or what we think is there. The other part of the immersion process that I think is really important is that a lot of times, especially dealing with engineers, people that, you know, are in large companies that don't necessarily work together, have worked together, have jumped around, whatever it might be, there's a lot of ego. I won't say always, but there tends to be ego, especially in the Y chromosome population. I'm not saying that, and this is, of course, a generalization, but...
So as someone who has a couple degrees in electrical engineering, you know, the stereotype might fit.
Yes. So, of course, these are generalizations. This is just my perspective, what I've experienced, what our organization. So what you have to do is you have to actually bring them in and break down those barriers of ego, of smartest person in the room. And sometimes people don't even know that they're doing it, right? So how we do that and we approach that is we bring them in the night before the immersion session starts, and we dine together. So we practice sort of European-style family gathering because it allows for those barriers and the uncomfortableness to be broken down slightly, right? So we've had these conversations that aren't about work necessarily, that aren't about, you know, the project at hand. It allows for some ease. And then what my boss calls the social lubricant, which is beer and wine, allows us to become a little more comfortable around each other, right? And to talk a little more freely than we would in a normal working business environment. I don't think that we give this enough credit for what it allows for in the sessions. And I think only as of in the last year or so that we've, you know, really honed in on the need for this, do we realize now how effective it is. And our customers and our clients who come up here, they almost become family to us, okay, sort of the second family. We become comfortable. We can talk about the challenges that we're facing. We're not so concerned about, you know, what people are saying. And it allows for the freedom to flow, the ideas to flow, and to come from all areas. And it's really effective, and it's a powerful tool.
You know, sounds like a lot of that is rapport building, right? And and in the work setting, we think of rapport as maybe unnecessary, doesn't actually get to solving the problem, right? We want especially if it's engineering, we want to know what the facts are, what the problem is, and how we get to the solution, right? And we can do all that without rapport, but rapport helps us when it gets frustrating and we're starting to disagree. You know, rapport, frankly, just makes us kinder to each other, right? Part of that is also trust building. And whenever we look at high-performing teams, you know, trust is a key ingredient. Mm-hmm. People that have good rapport and they trust each other, they're holding each other accountable for the results. You know, they're having effective conflicts, right? They're moving forward because they've had those kinds of social conversations, and they know they can work with each other well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, trust is a big factor in everything that we do in innovation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean, if you don't have trust, you're not going to get a whole lot done, in my opinion. Or it's not going to be effective.
So when you guys get together with the client, a small group at your innovation campus, you have done your secondary research already, and you're meeting, you have that social interaction, develop trust. What happens next? What's the environment like? What's that first day like?
Everybody's met the night before. Our engineers, you know, come to the dinner as well, so everybody's comfortable with each other already by the morning. And then we jump in. We say, okay, these are the challenges. And it varies, of course, right? We do a lot of questioning, face-to-face questioning that morning. Okay, so why is this? Try and understand it. Because the immersion process is not so much for them as it is for us. Right? We need to immerse ourselves into their problems. We have this sort of overarching understanding of what their need is. Mm-hmm. But they need to bring us up to speed, and a lot of times you're asking the why, right? Five whys over and over again in this first day, because we need to come up to speed of why they do that. What are the challenges that they're facing, all that stuff. And the face-to-face.
And what kind of environment are you in? I mean, physically, how do you set this up for this interaction?
So we actually have a brainstorming ideation studio. So it's just a big giant room with bathrooms, we have food, and we gather around a large ping pong table that doesn't get used as a ping pong table unless we need to take a break and play some ping pong. And then we have, you know, our charts, and, you know, it is in the country, so, you know, there's trees everywhere, there's walking paths, so you can walk right out, there's the pond right out front, so if you need to take a break, you can come sit by the pond, go fishing. So, you know, it's a very serene setting, but it's physically in just a brainstorming studio, which is just a vaulted ceiling, open space.
Lots of whiteboards.
Lots of, flip charts. Yeah. You know, all that good stuff. Projectors, if we need it.
Okay.
We do have internet access, but we try not to do that. We try to focus. Need to do some additional research.
Disconnected a bit.
Yes.
And that secondary research that you've done ahead of time, does some of that make its way into your innovation studio?
It does, yep. A lot of times we always have the rules of the immersion session, which are the typical rules of any sort of ideation brainstorming, you know, no naysaying, you know, try not to keep side conversations at a minimum. And then we have our stimulus material, which is typically, you know, it could be anything that we think might be effective. Some of it's not sometimes, but some of it is. It's basically a different way of thinking of things. And sometimes we have companies come in and go, oh, that's a yada yada. Hey, I wonder. Wow. Oh, and then they start to realize that this thing that is totally disconnected is actually not so disconnected from what they're doing, right? You know, sort of like biomimicry stuff, right? So taking biology and putting it into something that is an electromechanical system.
Right, a new stimulus for a possible solution.
Absolutely, yeah.
So as you described, I was thinking, you know, maybe some of the stimulus that you add there, like for companies that have other divisions doing work, you might come across some opportunities that you found in your secondary research where there might be some cross-pollination that could be beneficial that they may not be aware of. So does this look like maybe, you know, charts or brochures that you're hanging up on the walls in your studio of other related solutions, things that they might be able to pull in?
Yeah, it could be. It could be. And it's just pictures. It's never a text. Typically,
very
it's
visual.
Large. It's large pictures to where you're just sitting there and you can look around all the time and say, okay, what is that? How does that function? So it could be anything. Yeah, it could be whatever the team deems that they think could be stimulating to the task in the group at hand. So,
cool. Okay.
Yeah.
And this goes on for, you said, 3 to 5 days. So you're exploring during that time. Mm-hmm. Tell me more. What happens next?
So then, you know, typical ideation stuff, 100, 200 ideas. It's all documented. You know, once we have the problem statement, this is what we're trying to solve around. Now, how do we solve this problem? This. And it's never, you know, there's not an enabling technology to enable this yet. That's not what we're looking for. We're looking for any idea that might work. And I'm typically not in this, so I'm going to talk about these in broad picture from what I've experienced, because they do change based on, you know, the in-depthness. But typically it's, you know, big picture, the list, 200 ideas, the 400 ideas, however many. And then the voting, right? So you have to narrow it down. You have to get to some conclusion. And typically it's in groups. You know, you can see where the group is going by the end of that process. You know, we do actually a lot of concept sketching too. Mm-hmm. So you take an idea that you like, you break into groups and say, okay, we really love this idea. What could that look like? Mm-hmm. You know, concepts. Just pictures, you know, how does it function? You have to document a little bit, right? All the normal stuff.
And you mentioned you have prototyping capabilities at the campus there. Does that come into play during this time? Or are people building prototypes of possible concepts, making just sketches that come later?
So we can, but typically the challenges that we're solving are so technical that we don't actually get into the prototype, because they're not looking for like a physical, you know, we do a lot of industrial work, so they're not necessarily looking for a physical, how does it function or look, but sometimes we'll get into, I wouldn't say no, because we have done that, and that was we can and we will when necessary, but we haven't done that in a really long time, because it's not about the form and function. Typically, it's about the guts inside. Mm-hmm. So really, we're talking the technology capability and how do you bring all these different enabling technologies in to create something new. So,
yeah, but you bring in the tools to help everyone to kind of understand what this possible solution looks like in some sense, right? That might just be
absolutely.
A physical prototype, if that's helpful.
Yeah, and we can, absolutely.
And then towards the end of this process, so you've lots of ideas, you've done voting, you've refined. Mm-hmm. How does this get wrapped up?
So typically it's a path forward. It's okay. So this is what we've narrowed down to. We all agree as a group. And I think the beauty of the immersion session is that at the end of it, you all understand the reasoning behind why that is chosen, and there is agreeance upon the group. Sometimes you have two or three options that they want to explore more, just because of the nature of the challenges that they're trying to figure out. You know, when you're dealing in really nasty, like oil and gas, really nasty environments, you're just not sure you know, what's going to function and work. So then we make a, okay, these are the three options. Now we need to go do some feasibility, some mathematical modeling, but at least there's action items to be taken after the immersion session is over. Sometimes it's just a path forward. Hey, this is where we want to go. This is, you know, we want to figure out how to do it from here. And so there's always a path forward in some capacity, whether it's aspects or just moving forward. This is the product we want to develop. So.
Okay. Yep. Some clear paths to action to take.
Yeah. And like I said, I'm going to say it again, because it's really important, is that when you have the group together like this, the buy-in is key. And it makes moving forward that much easier, because everyone can look at it and say, yes, I agree. Okay. Or they can say, no, I don't agree. You know, what if we did this? But by the end, everyone is agreeing that this is the path forward, right? To the point that we say, sign of it, we agree that this is what we agreed upon, right?
Right.
Okay. So no one can go back and say, well, I didn't agree to that. But usually at that point, you're like, yes, this is awesome, because we're going to be able to move forward in at a pace that we wouldn't have been able to move forward at without this. So.
Yeah, and that's, I'm sure, why companies come to you in the first place, right? That they have something that looks promising that they need to figure out a way to develop further, or they are probably stuck, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Stuck. Mm-hmm. Well, God, okay, so lots of great kind of tips throughout the discussion, and let me review some of those, just pull out some real actionable things here. This practice of still getting out of your environment, you know, maybe taking your team off site, doing something different mm-hmm. environment, real helpful. And also, you bring in experts, right? Very specific pinpoint people that you find on a topic that problem needs. And I think that's another good thing we can do too, talking to others and getting their insights, relevant insights. So finding mm-hmm. people that can really help you with that. And several times, as you talk through your methodology and what you've done, it's very visual, a lot of visual hands-on kind of tools, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're not
mm-hmm.
trying to get bogged down in documents, but we're trying to make things more real. And information comes alive when we can see it. It's visual.
Yeah.
I certainly don't want to gloss over the value of social lubricating as it was described.
Right.
It's a build. And trying to you know, establish trust mm-hmm. in groups. I think we all, you know, we look forward to going to work when we're actually working with people we like.
Mm-hmm.
So what we can do to
makes it
that.
A little more enjoyable, doesn't it?
Sure does.
Yeah, makes the time pass a little more quickly.
Absolutely. So good tips that we can apply even if we can't make it off to a innovation campus. Something I like to ask is an innovation quote that has meaning to you. What's a quote about innovation that you like?
So I have two that I love.
Great. I would love to hear them both.
Well, I actually have quite a few, but, you know, for our purposes, I'll only dive into two.
Okay.
I can give you a list if you want. So one is from Elon Musk, and, you know, he's a very prolific innovator. And his quote is, if things are not failing, you are not innovating enough. And I think that is probably one of the most profound statements about innovation, is that failure is where you learn. Failure is,
right.
You know, learning from experience. That's an applied learning. I mean, it is. And I think too often we're not allowed to fail, because failure, we've been taught throughout our entire life that failure is bad. Perfection is good.
Starting in grade school.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, even before that, you know, our, as parents, we don't want our kids to mess up, because that means
right.
that they're bad or this. But it's a challenge, because on this one side, we want kids to be creative and thoughtful and unique, but then at the same rate, we're saying, step in line, don't do anything naughty, be just like him so you don't get in trouble, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do
and
we
those are the expectations we grew up with, right?
Yes, and we still have those expectations.
We want to avoid failing.
Yeah, so failure is not an option, right? But it has to be an option. So, because that's how we learn. That's how knowledge is created.
Yeah, such a great point. That is how we learn, right? So,
yeah,
I love that quote. If things are not failing, you are not innovating enough.
Yeah, because that's how you learn. That's how you figure out what works and what doesn't work. I mean, I'm sort of, it's very humbling to live in this world of innovation, and especially in a B2B world where it is so massive, and there are so many moving parts, and there is just so much information and knowledge to be gained and learned, and it's just, it's mind-boggling. Mm-hmm. From supply chain to, you know, I mean, it's just, it's crazy. It's crazy how big the world is. And so you just constantly have to just sort of be open to new things and saying, well, I'm, you know, and not make assumptions. I think that's one of the biggest challenges, to not make assumptions about the world and about what we know, because we just don't know. Every day we're learning new things about science and technology. And
run an experiment and see what you learn.
Yeah.
And what is the other innovation quote you want to share with us?
It is from one of the Wright brothers, Orville Wright. If we worked on the assumption that what is accepted as true is true, then there would be little hope for advance. And to me, that's very, also very profound, because, you know, we assume that we know everything. And if the Wright brothers had just said, well, humans don't have wings, we can't fly, then would we be where we are today with our ability to fly globally and transport ourselves? I mean, I think it's, assumptions should not be made.
Yeah.
You can assume certain things, but break them when needed.
Absolutely. And the Wright brothers were fighting against, you know, centuries worth of thought that heavier than air travel was impossible.
Yeah.
And if they accepted that, we would not have airplanes from them, at least.
I know. And you think about the failure, right? I mean, the failure, but the continued push and belief that it was possible.
All the attempted flights and what they learned from each one.
Until, man.
To the ground.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, I wish that, as someone who's in the innovative world, you know, I believe that I'm not a risk taker. Mm-hmm. Because I see the people who are true risk takers, and I do think it's something that you're almost born with.
And I think of risk as a little bit different, right? The you've talked about being curious lots of times for the importance of innovation. I used to be very risk adverse earlier in my career. Mm-hmm. And I think about risk differently, and I think about risk more in the failure sense that you talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And the real risk is going down a path where we don't have information to believe if that's a good path. You know, it's, you know, products fail not because we did a crummy job developing, it's because we developed the wrong thing. We developed something
right.
No one wants. And instead, if we're taking small, you know, experiments, learning from that, you know, mm-hmm. and we really quantify the risk. And so I think good innovators are actually really good about decreasing the risk.
Absolutely.
And think about it differently.
Yeah. No, I agree. And that there is a path forward. It's just how do we get there, and how do we... That's why stage gates are important, right? I mean,
yeah, some process. Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. It's key to success.
Very good. It's been a great pleasure talking with you, learning more about immersive ideation that you guys are doing, and how you're helping companies have breakthroughs and problems that they faced, and get product ideas into the market and commercialized. Mm-hmm. Thank you for contributing just to the profession through the writing you do and the speaking you do.
Oh, thank you. Can I just like to make one last note
Please. While
we're here? Anything is possible, I think, and that's something that's been instilled here at PCD Works. And I think that if we constantly challenge the status quo, that, you know, technology is available now to us, that we can solve the world's problems. We just have to collectively come together and say, what do we want to solve, and how do we want to move forward on it and do it. And there are people out there making headway every day, but each and every one of us, it comes down to people, each and every one of us is capable of truly great things and truly, truly great innovations if we allow ourselves to. So it's a powerful, powerful thing. Humans are powerful. We have so much ability. Let's put it towards something great. I love it.
Absolutely. You know, the times I feel I listen to too much news and think the world's falling apart, I recommend innovation. Keeps moving forward,
you know,
and we'll find the answers when we need them. So
yeah, absolutely.
It's a very uplifting message. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Of course.
Luis, again, thank you very much for talking with me today. I want to thank the audience for listening and appreciate them wanting to dive in more into the fields of product management and development and innovation, and look for another interview next week.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training Your Customers Will Love You For. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.